Blog Talk Radio.
This program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Basically, the 1% of the motorcycle community who operates outside the law.
Their total focus is on hatred for the enemy. They have a policy of shoot or kill on sight if they can.
It's bullshit. Law enforcement just tries to paint this picture to the media to just cover up their bullshit, cover up their lies, and I just like to say fuck them. That's straight from my...
Well, hello.
Hey.
What's going on?
It's a tad chilly side here. I'm glad I have a chance of snow. Huh?
That's the fact you're freezing your ass off.
Yeah. I was being polite about it.
Yeah. Nah, we're having some issues with this today. Almost didn't get on. We'll see how long it goes.
Oh. I know. Yeah.
No, I don't want to play games again.
Of course. That's how it is.
So, yeah.
So, I found that very interesting.
Which one?
It was an interesting watch. The video, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And with the camps and everything, and we know they're there. The only thing is... when it's going to start, who knows?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that it's going to get crazy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they already have those vehicles here that they kind of like the ones like from the UN, you know?
I wanted to switch gear.
Yeah. Yeah, nobody, them FEMA camps there, nobody believes it's coming.
Yeah, well, like I said, it's, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. Well, just to switch gears here for a second, check this out.
A little bit, Tom May. I guess last week.
This is the guy who he leaves his recorder by his phone just so he can record calls. Check this out.
Right.
I wanted to switch gears a little bit. Tom Mabe was our guest last week. He gets a lot of requests for this. He has a little stunt that he does. He leaves a tape recorder by his phone, and when the phone rings, he hits the button. And if it's a telemarketer, he records the call. Puts him on a little bit. And I thought we'd give this one a listen.
Hello? Yes, can I speak with Tom Mabe?
Yes, Carla.
So this is Mike with you've been selected to receive a complete digital satellite system for free. With this, you're going to...
Let me ask you something. Did you know Tom Mabe? Were you a friend of his?
No, I'm not. I'm just calling to...
Hold that thought. Hold on one second, all right? Hey, guys, get really good pictures of the body. Yeah, dust everything down for prints. Mike, you there?
Yeah.
Let me bring you up to speed. You've actually called a murder scene. Now, Mr. Mabe is no longer with us. Officer Clark, who conducts a homicide investigation. I want to ask you a series of questions. First of all, what was the nature of the business you had with Tom Mabe?
I had no business with him. I'm sorry to bother
you. No, hold on. Look, I want to ask you to stay on the phone. This call's already been traced, and we may need you to come in for further questioning.
I'm just calling.
No, look, you don't understand. Unless you want to be charged with obstruction of justice, it's imperative you keep your ass on the phone, Mike.
I just talked with my supervisor. Then.
No, look, we'll get your supervisor in a second here. First of all, give me your whereabouts.
I'm at work.
You're at work?
Yes.
You being a smart ass?
Yes, sir.
Let me put it to you this way, Mike. Say I wanted to mail your ass a letter. What would I have to write on the outside of the envelope to assure the mailman to deliver it right to your ass? Geographically speaking, Mike, where is work?
40 West
Littleton, Colorado.
Uh-huh. Now, hold on, that's cool.
Yes, sir.
Hold on one second, all right?
Yes, sir.
Get the Littleton Police Department Homicide Division on the phone. Yeah, give them this information. They tell me he's being socked in connection with a fatal shooting and aggravated robbery.
How did you know Mr. Mabe again?
Wait, you're calling the Littleton Police Department? I'm hundreds of miles away. I don't even know the guy. I'm in Colorado.
Don't let that scare you. That's just a formality.
Telemarketer calls, start asking questions like that. You don't like that one or what? That was funny.
That is funny.
Huh?
It's funny. I didn't laugh, but yeah, it's funny. It's different.
Well, yeah. I can't wait for... I got my recorder by the phone. I can't wait for him to call me. I'm going to start that shit.
That's one way to solve that problem.
Absolutely. I used to say, leave your number so I can call you at a more inconvenient time.
I used to like it. Before cell phones came out, when you just answer a regular phone, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Tony Morgue, stab him, we slab him.
Yeah.
Pretty much puts him to shut up.
Yeah.
I've gotten some where it was, I'm calling to know if you would like a woman I'm sighting in your house. I'm like, well, how do you know if I'm in the house or not? And how do you,
mm-hmm.
What would you do if it was a brick?
Mm-hmm.
They just get all messed up.
Yeah. No, it's just like the guys used to, when I was a kid, they used to call up and ask my mom if she needed a house tuck point. You know what that is, right?
Yes, I know what that is. I have my chimney tuck pointed.
Mm-hmm. Now, I got that video that I sent you.
Yeah.
And, this is about detention camps that I've been telling everybody that are going up. They're all over the United States.
Right.
Ten different regions across the... Well, the United States is divided up into 10 different regions right now. And
right.
This is from one of the regions, and then you'll hear where they go somewhere else through the states. But I'm going to play this right now.
Presence.
Well, those guys just showed up. They weren't here when we pulled up, and now they're on the move. So, you know, I'm going to head on to the next base. Yeah, I'm out of here.
It took a while. Finally, someone came out, the spokeswoman. What is this place?
This is the Tidonhoto Residential Center.
Residential center?
Yes, sir. Okay.
It looks like a prison. I mean, I've never seen a residential center that has two sets of fences go around. It looks identical to a prison to me.
Well, the reason I'm here is just to see what I can do for you today and
Well, you can answer my questions. Why does it look like a prison if it's a and I've never come to a residential center that has its front doors locked and you can't walk in and talk to a receptionist?
Well, the reason for that is to protect the privacy of the residents inside.
And why do they need protection?
Well, I tell you what I can do for you, sir. I'm more than happy to forward all your questions to our folks at ICE. They'd be more than happy to talk.
And ICE is?
And your Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Ah, okay.
And that's under Homeland Security?
Yes, sir. Okay.
Daniel followed the trail into the port of Los Angeles. William Lewis led him to another camp on Terminal Island, isolated, just like Alcatraz, with more barbed wire facing in. In Texas, I was getting tag-teamed by spokespeople. Just so I have it on the record, for a residential place, I've never seen one with a locked front door and double fences. It looks to me, it looks very much like a prison.
Well, we're charged with their safety as well, so.
Who's after them?
I'm sorry?
Who would be after them that you'd need double fences and this type of security? You got Al Capone in there? Daniel could see the evidence. But before he got any closer, the police moved in. And the cops weren't happy to see Daniel.
What is that I'm looking at right there?
We can't give that information.
All of what we've learned made it obvious. What we'd thought was a police state conspiracy is a concentration camp conspiracy. And everything is documented. I thought I'd seen enough. But Alex Jones wanted me to visit one more location.
Governor, there's just a little town up the road from here.
Madison, Georgia, on the side of Interstate 20, near train tracks, close to an airport, perfect for smuggling in people like you and me under the cover of darkness. But this place didn't need any barbed wire to keep people from getting out. What in the hell is this?
It's hundreds of thousands of plastic coffins.
So each one of those is a separate coffin stacked on top. There's probably, 20 to 25 per stack. And how many stacks? Literally hundreds of them.
And you can fit four dead bodies per plastic coffin. It's basically a giant body bag.
Tens of thousands of coffins. Officially, they're plastic grave liners. 7 feet long, 3 feet deep, with lids. The company that makes them says they're just being stored for people's pre-needs. Well, who in the hell has a pre-need for this many coffins? Unless they're planning a massacre. If they had to get rid of people or dissidents or whatever, they certainly got the caskets for it, don't they? What would their argument be, though? The place that makes these boxes used to be a research and development arm of Hercules Incorporated. Hercules is a major defense contractor with ties to Halliburton. The feds gave $385 million to a Halliburton subsidiary to build the detention centers. It seems everything that I'm investigating, the trail seems to lead to Halliburton all the time.
Exactly, Governor. The admitted Homeland Security contracts with those camp centers. I mean, that's admitted in the mainstream news. It's Halliburton. It always goes back to Halliburton.
But it doesn't end there. These detention centers and camps are run by FEMA. The federal agency that's supposed to help us in crisis is ready to round us up. FEMA already has the country divided into 10 regions, and they match almost perfectly with the Council of Governors' 10 sectors. And so these are sitting here waiting for the implement of martial law, possibly.
And remember, this is right outside where the Centers for Disease Control is based.
Alex Jones was about to fit the last piece of this puzzle, how the concentration camp plan would be put into action.
I'm going to give you some of these secret government documents that we've gotten from where they admit that they've got stockpiles for the biological pandemic. This is the perfect pretext to bring in martial law using the fear generated by a pandemic.
They start a pandemic as an excuse. An excuse to put away anybody who gets in the way of their power plan. The feds would trigger a nationwide outbreak of deadly disease. The bodies would pile up, the military would pile in, and the concentration camp gates would open.
We have government documents where the CDC is preparing for mass pandemics, hundreds of thousands or even millions dead. There's this massive preparation going on for plagues and literal megadeth.
Megadeth. Well, that's one way to put it. It makes you wonder about all the flus that spread like wildfire, how quickly they kill, all the outbreaks and vaccinations, and how simple it would be for the elites to put the plan into action. And we may have arrived just in time to expose the evidence. In the hours after we left, workers began hustling to get the coffins out of there. It was time to meet the ones who are making all this possible. Coming up, Jesse Ventura gets the runaround from congressmen too afraid to tell the truth about FEMA prison camps.
Actually, just left to go back to
prison. Oh, he did. And then, a congressman behind the law to build prison camps plays dumb.
Why is it in that bill? What is exactly in the bill?
Think it's history? Think again.
I have some very classified papers here.
They're still hiding secrets, and I'm about to bust them wide open. Nobody really thinks of George H.W. Bush being part of the JFK assassination.
Unlike the confession, no one saw coming.
He confessed that he participated in the murder of John Kennedy to you.
That's exactly true.
Conspiracy theory, all new, next Friday at 10 on TrueTV.
Jesse Ventura has found evidence of a government plan to use a disease outbreak and martial law to clear the way for concentration camps, ready to take in American citizens. Don't toe the line. Residentials.
Okay.
It looks like a prison. After stopping in at a storage yard filled with thousands of coffins, the governor has arrived in Washington. Now I've seen enough evidence. I want to know why our congressmen think we need prison camps for ordinary citizens. They put it right in a congressional bill, H.R. 645. I went to Washington to find some of the congressmen who co-sponsored the bill. And what happened gives a pretty good idea of how our nation has slid down the slippery slope to a possible police state. First, there was Congressman and co-sponsor Jim Gerlach of Pennsylvania. When I arrived at his office on Capitol Hill, his chief of staff said the congressman would be glad to see me. Until he found out what I wanted to talk about, these FEMA camps, then Gerlach ran away. On two separate occasions.
Oh,
he did. How convenient. He says he's all excited to talk to me all morning, and then we go in there and he heads home right after he finishes a vote. Yeah, right. Congressman Steve Cohen of Tennessee agreed to talk about the bill. Remember, he's a co-sponsor.
I'm here to talk to you about these FEMA camps. I'm very disturbed about them. Why would we be building these things all over the country? For what purpose?
Well, we wouldn't, because they don't exist. It's just a figment of some people who have concerns about maybe Martians or other creatures coming to infiltrate our society, thinking that there are such camps. But
so
there, are,
these, there are no such. So why was it put into that bill? It's in a bill, so it's put into the bill. It doesn't exist. There are no FEMA camps anywhere in America.
No, there aren't.
What was the place I saw in Texas?
I don't know what it was called, a residence. It had two 20-foot high fences around it. When I knocked on the door, it was locked. When the people came to the door, no comment was the answer I got on any question. And what disturbed me the most about this place was in the back, it was like a daycare. There's slides and swings for children. And I said, do you keep children inside this place? No comment. Have you ever kept children in this place? No comment.
I haven't been there, so I have no idea. Maybe right. They're immature people.
So you're telling me there isn't one FEMA camp of these in the United States right now?
There are not.
Why is it in that bill?
What is exactly in the bill?
It talks about building FEMA camps, doesn't it? In that particular bill that we're talking about?
I would have to. I'd like to see the bill.
Isn't this guy a co-sponsor of the bill? What's the bill number? Six FEMA camps built within the United States. How can a bill state that there'll be six FEMA camps built in the United States and then I'm being told there are none?
Well, I think I recall now something about this, and if I'm correct, I think those are locations for if there's a disaster like in Katrina. I think that's what it is. It's not any kind of a concentration camp or anything to round up citizens.
He thinks that's what it is? The bill that he co-sponsored says the use of the camps will be determined by the Secretary of Homeland Security. They can come and go as they please.
Exactly.
They won't be locked.
No,
can go in and out because the place I saw in Texas is locked. You can't go in and out of it. No comment.
Well, it's not probably not being used either for a couple
of years. Well, we have films of children playing on the swings and the slides and stuff, and this one technically falls under Homeland Security.
Well, I don't know. You know, I haven't been there, and I don't know who the children are, and the children are probably very happy.
Where have we heard that before?
They're probably children of the people that manage the place, I imagine. But they're not people that have been taken there, you know, by some green monsters and a machine.
I have fear of my government, not green monsters and machines from outer space. I have enough fear from here. See how things work in Washington. Congressmen sponsor bills because they're told to or because it means money for their district. Back at Jim Gerlich's office, his chief of staff admitted as much.
I've seen some things on the internet, and I know he talked to some folks back in the district that led him to co-sponsor it. In light of some of the new information out, he may want to reconsider that, of course.
Second thoughts about putting his name on a bill he probably didn't even read. If enough of us speak out, maybe next time we can talk some sense into our leaders before they sign on the dotted line. Here, but it already is happening, and we've already allowed our elected officials to break all kinds of laws designed to protect you and me. You thought we had 50 states? Nope. We've learned there's 10 sectors ruled by 10 people you didn't vote for. You support your local police? That's nothing, not when they've got the military ready to take over. You signed a petition outside the supermarket? Who knows what list you're on now? And what about all these detention centers? Why do you think the standard answer is no comment? And here's what's worse. They're doing it all in the name of national security. Talk about the fear factor. I've said it before and I'll say it now. I'd rather face the dangers than lose my freedom. I'm Jesse Ventura, and this is Conspiracy Theory.
Shit, huh? Hello?
Shit, they look better.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on. I got problems with the that server again. This is for all those people on the East Coast. Let me see if I get this figured out.
Yeah, yeah. Mike P, the big homie. Summertime in the valley, homie. Yeah, come on.
C-A-L-L-E-Y, we say G up and fly all the time, yeah. Summertime in the SFV, something for my 818 homies. C-A-L-L-E-Y, we say G up and fly all the time, yeah. Summertime in the SFV, something for my 818 homies. It's summertime in the valley, baby. It's summertime in the valley, It's summertime in the valley, baby. It's summertime in the valley. Twist the bottle open, homie, throw away the cap. Cause where we going, man, we don't need that. All we need is a 30 pack, a pack of Jimmy's trash, pack of hood rats, and a paddock kicking at. I think I'll call Swim, see what's up with him. If I can throw some hoes in the pool again. When it comes to having fun, I'm a motherfucking addict. Once again, I'm back at it, baby mama, too dramatic. And goddammit, it's about that time. Then drink up the vodka, beer and wine. Not even Friday night, drunk for the 10th time. So what the fuck, I guess I'll bust another rhyme. And drink beer and screw, hang on the avenue and go home with you when the party ends. Mike P back again, representing. C-A-L-L-E-Y, we say G up and fly all the time, yeah. Summertime in the SFV, something for my 818 homie. C-A-L-L-E-Y, we say G up and fly all the time, yeah. Summertime in the SFV, something for my 818 homie. Caribbean, waterfalls, waterfalls, let's slip, let's fly, jump in the pool, act a fool, I'm way too cool, call me GQ Smooth, it's a player's holiday, so it's time to celebrate, got chicken on the grill, put some beer and steak, the feeling so great in the 818, it's the summertime breeze for the summertime G's, and the summertime ladies with the double double G's, C-A-L-L-E-Y, we say G.
Well, you know, I got some new, The Devil's Rise is going to be on for season 3 starting February 3rd, and I was asked to do this today, so I'm going to do it, and there you go.
Kill for him, I die for him without hesitation, you know.
I mean, this is supposed to be a brotherhood of good times. This is not supposed to be a fast way into the morgue.
If you guys aren't ready to take a bullet for this thing, you better not be here, because this is on.
Yeah, are you there now?
Use Chase Freedom at gas stations this quarter and get 5% cash back. So you can keep rolling in style. Activate your 5% cash back at Chase.com.
Let's see. Yeah, it's true with those things now, too. Let me see if I can find it. These guys, they're jacking with. I can't keep knocking me out of what I want to get into. Let's see if I can find it here. We'll go another way. see if we can get this one going. This is the new theme song for The Devil's Ride. Hold on. All right, if anybody has trouble hearing this, let me know.
Oh, that's how we roll. Mr. One Tank, a.k.a. Mike P, the big homie.
Man, we live that club life on our bikes every night. You know who we are, neighborhood stars. Spend every night at a neighborhood bar. Harley D's, we rolling pipes loud. Yeah, they keep on with. Feeling good when I'm rolling in the pack. Pants on my back, but you know about that. Anyway, oh, let's ride. USA on worldwide. Rain and shine. Day and night, you know we live club life. If you got a chance, you better take it. You have enough, you just might make it, huh?
So much on his car insurance with Geico, dude wanted to commemorate the moment with a glamorous photo.
Hold still, Mr. Tickle. Don't you get all cattywampus now.
Whoa!
Geico.
15 minutes could save you 15% or more.
Yeah, it's
I didn't know that they were going on their third season. I don't know where the heck I've been. I thought they only had one season. That was it.
No, they had, one and a half, actually. They claimed it as two, but no, they actually have a lot of familiar faces. You'll know a lot of those faces when you see the show.
Okay.
And you might see me and the white-haired guy.
Really?
Really.
Very impressive.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when does it start?
Monday, February 3rd, it'll be on.
Okay, so it'll be after the Super Bowl. Okay, awesome. And, isn't that TNT? No.
No, it's going to be on Discovery.
Discovery, that's it. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'll be on Discovery, and it's gonna be it'll be real interesting, and it'll actually be more believable than the shit you saw the first two seasons.
Well, it was okay.
Mhm. Because basically they're they're using some actors, but they're using real club guys.
Right.
Mhm. Yeah, you'll see some familiar faces. If you go and if you go on Discovery Channel and look it up,
okay,
and watch the trailers, you'll see a lot of familiar faces.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Can we?
And for people who want to know what a SAG card is, this is the Screen Actors Guild. It's like a union card for the an actor. So, yeah, it's just going to be a lot interesting. But the topic today was what to do when you get, let me see here if I can find it. It's actually, what are my rights when we're pulled over? Did you happen to get that?
Yes.
And today's thing is, what are my rights when I'm pulled over by a cop? And everybody's hit me up.
I know.
Yeah. It's just.
Do you want me to read this?
Henry, it's okay. Like a green card. Yeah, it's like a green card. No, somebody wanted to know what a SAG card was. So I said it's a Screen Actors Guild card, so you can get you're in the union, you get paid. Anytime you're you get paid.
Okay. True.
Yeah, quite different from the green card, Henry, but tomorrow, just to refresh a lot of people's if they hadn't seen it today, tomorrow is No Panties Day.
Okay. Well, the one show morning thing will be over, so all right.
Yeah.
No problem.
Yeah, Janine, again, No Panty Day. But no one likes seeing flashing blue lights, blue and red lights in the rearview mirror. While the police officer behind you may simply be rushing off to the site of some other crime. Well, yeah, you pay for green cards, Henry. That's why a lot of people kicking out of base, they got caught. So now you got to show, like, going to work now? Since Henry brought this up, I'll bring it up since he brought up green cards. But you get out of base now, you need to show a U.S. passport. Like, no ticky, no washy. You don't have it, they turn you around right before you're in line. They stop the cars and make you turn around. But no one likes seeing red and blue lights in the rearview mirror. Yeah, Henry's life day, Janine. No panty day. But when you're pulled over by a cop, be mindful of your legal rights to avoid incriminating yourself. Because you have the right to ask him to identify himself or show his badge and identification. This information is important for two reasons. First, you want to ensure you're not allowed to become the victim of a criminal impersonating a police officer. Second, you need this information to feel you were treated ill by the officer and want to file a complaint. Don't answer any questions. When you're pulled over, be very careful what you say. Besides providing your name, driver's license, vehicle registration, and proof of insurance, you do not have to answer any questions the officer directs at you. You are allowed to answer questions like, do you know why I pulled you over? Do you know how fast you were going? With a simple yes or no. You can also choose not to give an answer. Silence is not an admission of guilt, but the officer can use anything you say to write a ticket. If you're pulled over and they do not automatically have the right to search your car. However, if the officers have probable cause, then they can. Probable cause can be established by the officer seeing something in your car through the windows or by your actions. For example, if they see you throwing something on your car as you're pulling over or if your actions create suspicion after they pull you over. In your admission of guilt, when a police officer gives you a ticket for a driving infraction, it's not a summary judgment. Rather, the citation is a charge from the officer to which you can either plead no contest or pay or challenge in court. As this the case, you do not have to give anything to the officer when you are pulled over. If he informs you that you were speeding, you can say, I see, or some other non-committal comment. Only have to acknowledge that you are being given a ticket, not that you deserve it. Let me get to this other thing right here. Let's see. Well, let's see. All right. This is very interesting. What did you get out of that?
Oh, me?
Yeah.
As always, shut up. Only say a little bit on your basic and the rest of it, shut up.
Yeah.
You don't have to tell them anything. You don't even have to show them your driver's license. They know who you are when they pull you over. They've already got you ran.
Yeah. But, it's when you see the police car. If he's following you with the siren blaring, emergency lights flashing, pull over to the right safely.
Oh, yeah, you have to pull over to the safest nearest spot. You can't just always stop right in the middle of the lane, you know, unless if you don't have any choice.
You got to.
And then they're going to touch the car, approach you, and say, license, driver's registration, all that crap, you know, and, then they'll sit there and say why they pulled you over. It's normally the rule of thumb, or, as you said, why did I pull you over? Well, some they don't even need a reason. They just do it.
Yeah. I mean, if you're pulled over by the police, this is kind of what you do and say. By stopping as soon as you can, you have a better chance to figure out exactly what officer says you committed a violation. You may want to return to that area later to make sure the officer was telling the truth, but he or she judged your speed, saw your turn, or witnessed any other violation.
Right.
After you pull over to a safe spot, you might want to show the officer a few other token courtesies. At this point, you have little to lose and perhaps something to gain. Now, this one says, first of all, roll down your window all the way. You also turn off the engine, place your hands in the steering wheel. If it's dark, turn on your interior light. Well, I don't know. Usually when I get it, I get a spotlight in my face, and I don't have to turn on any lights. I just put my hands up.
Well, I had that, too. I was pulled over by a state trooper, you know. And it was just because I had problems on the front end of my car, but it was a real windy night, so on my way home from work. Of course, the officer didn't have any idea, just saw me swerving some on the line, you know, pulled me over, saw that I was in my work clothes, flashed a flashlight, you know, showed him my ID, had the window all the way down, had my hands on the steering wheel. He's like, can I help you, you know? And he's like, well, I was concerned. I was behind you, and I saw that you were on the line. I said, yeah, I have front-end alignment problems. I'm just going up to the next exit from work, and, you know, let's go get fixed in the morning. And he's like, he looked at my license, and, oh, okay, here you go.
Well, did you just tell him? Did you just tell him that you thought your car was unsafe to drive?
I told him I had front-end alignment problems.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
I told him I got fixed in the morning. I said, there's nothing I can do. I only have one vehicle. I get back and forth to work.
Okay.
You know, and he was just like, okay, I just wanted to make sure that you were okay because I saw you a little bit on the line. I said, no, I'm fine. I just got off from work, you know, and he saw my uniform, my name tag and everything. So I said, if you need to verify that, it's no problem. I'll give you the number. He's like, no, no. He said, I'll just, you know, stick behind you until you get off at the next ramp. I said, okay, thank you. Have a nice night. And that was it. You know, I wasn't an idiot or a jerk or nothing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was only ever pulled over twice in my life, so. Oh, yeah, I was a bad person. And both car-related issues. One was for the muffler, and the other one was for my front end. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, don't start rummaging through your back pocket or your wallet for in the license or your glove compartment. You might think you're reaching for a gun. You know, they just had a guy they tased out here the other day. And then another guy who
really?
Totally, yeah, I don't know. It didn't say. And then they had another guy who called. Basically, he just got out of jail and he was going to check himself in, and they refused him because they said one of the cold medicines he took didn't allow him to be taken into the detox center. So, yeah. So they get pulled over on 15 going north, and the next thing you know, taken off. He gets on the phone, calls the police department, tells him he's got a gun and a hostage.
Oh, God.
And then he wonders why he got shot to death. Well, his people wonder why he got shot to death.
Right.
He made a move like he was going to hurt the driver, which was a woman, and the next thing you know, one shot, one kill.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it happens all the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, many people stop an officer, make the mistake of saying the wrong thing to him or her, and failing to say the right things. And a case can be won by depending on what you say or don't say to the officer. Don't speak first. Especially don't start with the defense for hostile. What's the problem? Or similar words. Let him start talking. Like Bill said, the first 30 to 45 seconds, you'll be able to know who's going to control this to stop. He probably asked to see your license and registration. Many people make the mistake of insisting the officer tell them why they were stopped before they'll comply. Don't make that mistake. Reply okay or sure, then hand over the documents. One of the first things traffic cops learn in the police academy is to decide before leaving their vehicle whether they're going to give a ticket or just a warning.
Right.
They still haven't made up their minds and are going to let you off only if you cooperate. Don't fall for this. The hesitating officer may be trying to appear open-minded in order to extract admissions out of you. Use them against you in court if necessary. The strategy is to try and get you to admit either that you committed a violation or that you were so careless, inattentive, or negligent that you didn't know whether or not you did or not. You might start by asking you sort of questions like the definite answer would imply guilt, like, do you know why I stopped you? You know how fast your answers, if any, should be non-committal and brief, like, no. If first question or a very confident, yes, I do, to the second. If the officer then tells you how fast he thinks you were going or what he thinks you did, don't argue. Give the noncommittal answer like, I see, or no answer at all. Silence is an admission of guilt and cannot be used against you in court.
Well, like I said, I never had a bad experience because, never broke the law. But, you know, I mean, I have seen people and been in the car with people where they were, an officer would sit there once approaching or had approached the door, you know, and, well, if you tell me this, you know, I'll let you go with a warning. I've seen that happen. I have seen it happen, you know, and where the person just got a warning, and okay, you know. And it happened to my daughter once. She was at the store, and I don't know, she pulled out, like, on the wrong side or something, and a cop was right there and pulled her over, and he asked her for her license. She gave it to him. And so he's like, I will give you a warning, but if I find anything on your license right now, I'm going to give you the chance to tell me if there's anything I need to know before I look it up and to let you off with a warning. So that her license was clean, you know, and he ran it and came back and said, okay, here you go.
Oh, here's the guy that's going to tell you what to do.
Okay.
In a phrase of the Fifth Amendment.
I was invited to give you a taste of a typical law school classroom experience here today, and I thought I would take advantage of this opportunity to do something that's been on my mind for a while, to stand up and to proudly say, God bless America, God bless the Bill of Rights, and thank God for the Fifth Amendment. I'm not ashamed to say I'm proud of the Fifth Amendment, and I'm proud to admit on camera and on the Internet that I will never talk to any police officer under any circumstances, with all due respect, sir. I'm doing something really extraordinary here today, something you'll almost never see another law professor do as long as you live. I'm really putting myself on the spot here. This was my idea. By my invitation, I have given up half of my time, approximately. I'm giving equal time and the last word to an expert who really knows something about what I'll be talking about. So I'm opening myself up to the possibility that he will contradict me. I was a criminal defense attorney when I was in private practice. So I want to make sure, in fairness to you, if I'm misleading you, giving you a slanted or one-sided presentation, you'll be able to get the last word from somebody else. I'm sure he'll have a lot to teach all of us, including myself. The Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution provides, no person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. And this unfortunate amendment has gotten a bad rap in recent times, much of it tragically and unnecessarily through, as you may have heard, the headlines. There was a recent Regent Law School graduate who was in all the news for a couple of weeks. She was an outstanding former student of mine, and she really got quite a lot of undeserved flack for the fact that she chose to exercise her right to remain silent when the Senate wanted to ask her certain questions that arguably might have tended to incriminate her. All of the world was aghast. The Christian community in particular looked at this and said, how could a Christian do such a thing? How could a Christian take the Fifth Amendment? And I said, you go, girlfriend. I do the same thing. I'll do it every time. And I want to talk to you about why that's true, but first a quick listening test. Let me read to you something that was taken out of the newspaper this morning, and I want you to listen to it closely. And I'm giving you a heads up. I'm warning you in advance, which is not fair to you. Not fair to me, but I'm giving you a warning that I'll be quizzing you on this in just a few minutes. This will test your aptitude for legal study and legal practice. Listen closely. It won't take long. Last night, agents of the Norfolk Police Department found three victims of an apparent murder dead in an apartment in the East Ocean View area, the apparent victims of a gangland-style slaying, and possibly the victims of gang-related violence. The police are investigating this as a possible murder and suicide, but right now suspect that the three were all killed by the same individual. No suspects have yet been identified in the slaying, but veteran police detective George Brook has confirmed the police are following up on evidence pointing to the possible involvement of an off-duty naval officer as the perpetrator. The bodies, which were found by the apartment manager at about 8 o'clock in the morning, appear to have been slain sometime earlier in the same evening, probably sometime between midnight and 2 o'clock in the morning. That's it. Those are all the facts I'll ask you to remember, and it won't be for very long either. Let's see how well you do. I'll be quizzing you in just a few minutes. Now, here's the easiest question you'll ever get from a client in all the days of your life. Question, hey, the police are here. They want to talk to me. What should I do? Well, I can give you my answer to that question in case you haven't already guessed it, but why don't we go to a real expert, Justice Robert Jackson. A prosecutor's prosecutor. Like me, he began his private practice in Buffalo, New York, years before I did, and after that he served as general counsel for the Bureau of Internal Revenue, the U.S. Department of the Treasury, the Security and Exchange Commission, Assistant U.S. Attorney General for the Tax Division, later the Solicitor General and the Attorney General of the United States, and then the Chief U.S. Prosecutor for the Nuremberg Trials. That's an impressive resume. Years later, when he was a justice on the Supreme Court, Justice Jackson stated, quote, any lawyer worth his salt, today we would say his or her, will tell the suspect, his client, in no uncertain terms to make no statement to the police under any circumstances. There's the title of my talk. I'm here to explain to you the surprising and somewhat counterintuitive and admittedly unlikely reasons why Justice Jackson was right. I'm reminded of this because I'm amazed. We're all amazed by the frequency with which we see newspaper articles coming up all the time from people who really ought to know better, who say, well, I'll talk to the police. I mean, after all, I'm a senator. I'm O.J. Simpson. I'm an experienced, highly polished individual. I've got a lot of experience with public relations, even criminal defense attorneys. There was a local news story here in the Virginia Pilot just a couple of months ago about an experienced criminal defense lawyer who ended up getting convicted of criminal assault because he talked to the police. He was accused of having assaulted another attorney in the hallway. There were no other witnesses to this. A woman said that he grabbed her by the throat during an argument over a case. He denied it. At trial, it was his word against hers. He said, I did not even touch her. But unfortunately for him, when the police had approached him earlier and said, would you be willing to answer some questions? He said, sure, why not? I'm an attorney. I'm a criminal defense attorney. I'm savvy. I'm sophisticated. I've got oratorical prowess. I'm accustomed to dealing with the police, by all means. And then there was a conversation that was not recorded. When the case went to trial, it was no longer his word against her. When he testified, well, I never touched her. The officer took her to the stand and testified, well, when I met with him, he said he did put his hand on her throat, but just as a joke. Then he had to take the stand again and say, that's not true. I never said that. I never admitted to you that I... Now it's his word against two people. Who's telling the truth? We'll never know for sure. But he was found guilty. Now, here's part of the problem. The heart of the problem, as Justice Breyer on the U.S. Supreme Court explained in 1998, is, quote, the complexity of modern federal criminal law codified in several thousand sections of the United States Code and the virtually infinite variety of factual circumstances that might trigger an investigation into a possible violation of the law make it difficult for anyone to know in advance just when a particular set of statements might later appear to a prosecutor to be relevant to some investigation. One expert on criminal law recently noted that estimates of the current size of the body of federal criminal law vary, although it has been reported that the Congressional Research Service can no longer even count the current number of federal crimes. That's right. Even the federal government has lost count. These laws are scattered over all 50 pages of the U.S. Code, encompassing roughly 27,000 pages. Worse yet, these statutes often incorporate by reference to the provisions of administrative regulations. Estimates of how many such regulations exist are even less well settled, although the ABA thinks there may be nearly 10,000. Here's one of those 10,000 federal criminal statutes on the book that you probably never heard about. It's called the Lacey Act. 16 U.S.C. Section 3370 says it's a federal offense for any person to import, export, transport, sell, receive, acquire, or purchase any fish or wildlife or plant taken, possessed, transported, or sold in a violation of any law, treaty, or regulation of the United States or any Indian tribal law or any state or any foreign law. People have been convicted in federal court for violating this statute because they brought back a bony fish from Honduras, not knowing that Honduran law, not American, but Honduran law, forbade the possession of the bony fish. People have been convicted under the list law because they were found in possession of what's called a short lobster. A lobster that's under a certain size. Some states forbid you from possessing a lobster if it's under a certain length. It doesn't matter if he's dead or alive. It doesn't matter if you killed it or if he died of natural causes. It doesn't even matter if you acted in self-defense. Did you know that? Did you know it can be a federal offense to be in possession of a lobster? Admit it. Raise your hand if you did not know that. There's the problem. And that's only one of 10,000 different ways. You know, the government gets pretty upset when people like me instruct the client, people like me and Justice Jackson, don't talk to the police, don't answer any questions. But, you know, they can't have it both ways. You people, you've got 10,000 different ways of convincing us, good for you, but, you know, where the bitter comes to the sweet, where the good comes to the bad, that's 10,000 different ways my client might unknowingly implicate himself in some sort of a criminal transaction. One of the reasons I decided to give this talk, I recently received a phone call from a former student of mine, a Regent Law School graduate, who may be watching this online. We're putting it on the internet. And he told me, hey, I've been approached by the Internal Revenue Service. They want to ask me a couple of questions. They ask if I'd be willing to. But they say that I'm not a suspect, and I know in my heart that I don't think I've done anything wrong in violation of the Internal Revenue Service provisions. Lord have mercy. There's no man on earth, there's no woman in this country who can honestly say with complete confidence, I know I have never violated any provision of the Internal Revenue Code. He said, but they say I'm not a suspect, and I know I've done nothing wrong. It's okay if I talk to him. I said, no, you tell them you will not talk to them without immunity. I explained to him why that was true, and he never heard from them again. Okay, why you should never talk to the police. Let me just spell it out for you. Let me make it plain to all of you. These are the top 10 reasons. I don't actually really lie to you. I don't really have 10. I don't have time for 10, but I've got time for 8, and that'll be close enough. Number one, and this really ought to be good enough. Contrary to what you laymen instinctively and naturally suppose, it cannot help. There is no way it can help you. Plenty of folks think that it can, and they're always wrong. You cannot talk your way out of getting arrested. Officer Brooke, you've interviewed thousands of criminal suspects. Have you ever, how many times in your experience, have you approached someone, asked if you could ask them some questions because prior to the interview you had some evidence pointing to his possible guilt? And because of the extraordinary persuasiveness and eloquence with which he articulated his innocence, you said, oh, sorry, never mind. Bad call, my bad, I won't, and he talked you out of arresting him. Never. Never, it never happens. I've often asked other criminal defense attorneys, in all of your experience, have you ever once had a case where you looked back in hindsight and said, thank God my client talked to the police? They laugh at me. They laugh at me. They say, you've got to be kidding me. You cannot help you. You can't talk your way out of getting arrested. And contrary to what you might suppose if you never studied the rules of evidence, what you tell the police, even if it's exculpatory, cannot be used to help you at trial. Because it's what we call hearsay. Under the rules of evidence, specifically Rule 801D2A, if you want to look it up, everything you tell the police, as the saying goes, can't and will be used against you, but it cannot be used for you. From time to time, I've known attorneys who try to call to the stand a police officer and say, officer, would you tell the jury what my client told you because what my client told him is actually good for my case? If you try that at trial, the prosecutor will object to it as hearsay, and the judge will agree. The police will not be allowed, at your request, to tell the jury what your client told him, no matter how good it may be for your case. It cannot help. And that ought to be good enough reason. That ought to be reason enough to keep your mouth shut. But if you're not persuaded, let me go talk about a couple of others. Number two, obviously one of the most obvious, if your client is guilty, as many of them are, but even if he's not, even if he's innocent, he may well admit his guilt with no benefit in return. Now, of course, many of you are thinking to yourself, well, what's so wrong about that? I mean, shouldn't guilty people be confessing? Confession's good for the soul. It's good for law enforcement. It's good for the prisons. Yes, sure, all those things are true. And like the rest of you, if I or anyone close to me is ever the victim of some crime, I hope they get the right guy. I hope they convict him. I hope they put him away. We all feel that way. Hey, but what's the rush, friend? You don't got to admit your guilt the first time they come by to meet with you. In federal court, 86% of all defendants plead guilty at some point before trial. If your client is guilty and really ought to punish and really ought to have a go through some sort of a cleansing act of contrition and fess up and admit his guilt, there'll be plenty of time to do that. They almost always do. No need to rush. No need to tell the police something. Wait and see if perhaps your client can work out some sort of an arrangement where maybe he'll make some sort of compensation to the alleged victim, or maybe he'll be able to get some sort of a discount in his sentence, and he'll be treated fairly then, like everybody else who had the benefit of a good lawyer who said, please do not talk to the police. And don't forget, by the way, even if your client only admits things that the police already knew, you might think, well, what harm can it do? He says he wants to talk to the police. All he wants to do is admit that he was there, but the cops know that he was there. All right, go ahead and tell them. Well, how can it hurt? It might hurt if the police officer becomes transferred to Minnesota, or deceased, or injured, or comatose, or cannot be located by the time of trial, the case will be dismissed if there's no confession. But if your client admits two things, that confession is freely admissible against him and can be a basis for getting him convicted all by himself. Senator Larry Craig can explain all of this to you. Innocence Project of the United States has confirmed that in more than 25% of all the cases where an innocent man was convicted and then later released from prison after he was exonerated by DNA evidence, in more than a quarter of those cases, these innocent people, people we know to be innocent, made incriminating statements, delivered outright confessions, or pled guilty. How do they do that? He'll tell us all about it, I trust. Here's a couple of famous examples. You can just ask them. You don't have to take my word for it. There on the left was Eddie Joe Lloyd. He was convicted in 1984 of the murder of a 16-year-old girl in Detroit after he wrote to police with suggestions on how to solve various recent crimes. During several interviews, police fed details of the crime to Mr. Lloyd, who was mentally ill, and they lied to him and convinced this mentally ill man that by confessing, he might help them smoke out the real killer. He later signed a confession, gave a tape-recorded statement. The jury delivered it less than 1 hour before convicting him on the basis of this confession. There was no other substantial evidence against him. The judge said, I'd hang you if I could, but the death penalty was not available in Michigan at the time. But after almost 2 decades in prison, he was released after DNA evidence proved that this man was innocent and had falsely committed, confessed to a crime that he did not commit. On the right is Earl Washington, who was released from prison just a few years ago here in Virginia. After spending 18 years behind bars, after being committed of a rape and a murder that we now know he did not commit, after having been exonerated by DNA evidence. But this man, Mr. Washington, who was in fact confirmed to be mentally retarded, was able to confess to several crimes at the request of the police, some of which we know he could not have committed. That's the problem. Some of you are thinking to yourself, well, none of this concerns me because I'm not guilty of anything and I never will be and I will never represent the people who do. Okay. Let's talk to you people. You innocent folks. Those of you who have never committed a crime and never will, and none of your clients will either. And you wouldn't go out with a girl who did. Fine. You better not talk to the police either. Okay? Because number three, we'll put the guilty behind us. Forget about them. Let's talk about innocent people. Number three, even if your client is innocent and he denies his guilt, and almost entirely tells the truth, odds are good he will easily get carried away and tell some little lie or make some little mistake that will hang him. This is human nature. He gets in there, it's a stressful situation. Imagine a perfectly innocent client. The police say he's been guilty of a murder. He's totally innocent as any one of us. So he goes in there and he meets with the police. He says, I don't know what you're talking about. I was nowhere near there. I didn't kill him. I've never killed anybody. I don't have a gun. I've never had a gun. I've never touched a gun in my life. I was nowhere near Virginia Beach that night. That last line was a lie. He went over the top. He was getting carried away. He got into this groove. He started saying all kinds of things, almost all of them true, that he knew would tend to exculpate himself. Then he got carried away and just said one thing that wasn't true. And unfortunately for him, they can prove that it wasn't true. He may be convicted on that basis alone. But let's say, well, that's not a problem. I'll tell my client only to tell the truth. I've met with him. I know he won't lie to the police. He won't make any mistakes. Okay, that's still no guarantee he won't be getting into trouble. Because even if your client is innocent and only tells the truth and doesn't say anything that is false. Now, already, mind you, we're pretty well nigh into fantasy land. The odds of this being anybody being able to pull this off are really quite slim, no matter how innocent they may be. But just for the same, let's pretend. Let's assume he gives the police nothing but the truth, and he is totally innocent. He will always give the police some information that can be used to help convict him. Always. For example, suppose you tell this to the police. Here's what your client tells to the police in his denial of guilt. I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't kill Jones. I don't know who did. I wasn't anywhere near that place. I don't have a gun. I've never owned a gun in my life. I don't even know how to use a gun. Yeah, sure, I never liked the guy, but who did? I wouldn't kill him. I've never hurt anybody in my life, and I would never do such a thing. Let's suppose every word of that is true, 100% of it is true. What will the jury hear at trial? Officer Brooke, was there anything about this, your interrogation, your interview with the suspect that made you concerned that he might be the right one? Yes, there was. He confessed to me that he never liked the guy. And then the prosecutor will put that up in big letters, and he'll say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, it's pretty clear that we've got the right guy here. We've proven that he was in Virginia Beach that night. That's opportunity. And remember, Officer Brooke admitted that after extended questioning, he was finally able to get the defendant to admit that he never liked the guy. There's your motive. Motive plus opportunity. Wham, bam. Please. But jury beat it up. And innocent people get convicted this way sometimes. How often? Hopefully not too often, but we know it happens. The United States Supreme Court, don't take my word for this, in Ohio versus Ryan, the Supreme Court of the United States said, quote, one of the Fifth Amendment's basic functions is to protect innocent men who otherwise might be ensnared by ambiguous circumstances. Truthful responses of an innocent witness, as well as those of a wrongdoer, may provide the government with incriminating evidence from the speaker's own mouth. See, it's not just some criminal defense attorney telling you this. Even the Supreme Court says, I'm right. In the fact, under the facts of that case, by the way, in Ohio versus Reiner, a child tragically was died, apparently the result of shaken baby syndrome. The question was who had shaken this baby to death. And one of the possible suspects was a babysitter who had spent some time with the child that week. The babysitter's story was, I don't know what you're talking about. I did not kill the child. I did not see it happen. I don't know who shook the baby. It was never me. I never did anything of any violent nature to the child. The Ohio State Court said, well, you've got no Fifth Amendment privilege. You, by your own admission, told the investigators that you've done nothing wrong, that you were not involved. So obviously your answers can't incriminate you. The United States Supreme Court reversed and said, well, that's not true. Even though this babysitter denies shaking the child, denies seeing the child die, denies knowing how the child died, this babysitter, by her own admission, apparently the government wanted to ask whether the babysitter might have been with the child at some point that week, during the week prior to the death. And that answer, although by itself not sufficient to convict anybody, could help convict her. That means she's got a Fifth Amendment right to refuse to answer to the question the court held, because it could be used to help convict. Allman versus United States, the Supreme Court said more than 50 years ago, eerily prophetic. They said too many Americans, even those who should be better advised, view this privilege as a shelter for wrongdoers. They too readily assume that those who invoke it are either guilty of crime or commit perjury in claiming the privilege. That's not true, and it never has been. But it gets worse. Can it get worse? It can. Number five, even if your client is innocent and only tells her the truth and does not tell the police anything incriminating, which, by the way, is almost impossible to pull this off. I mean, imagine talking to the police for 2, 3, 4 hours. And somebody like him can't somehow manage to extract from you something that could be used to help convict you. That'd be extraordinary. I don't think anybody pulled it off. But even if you could pull it off, there's still a grave chance that his answers can and will be used to crucify you in a court of law if the police, no offense, don't recall his testimony with 100% accuracy. All right, now this brings us back to that pop quiz I warned you about. I told you earlier, remember, it's only been a few minutes, and you weren't up all night, and you weren't the subject of physical duress. You were in the relaxed setting of a classroom here. You were given heads-up, advance notice that you would be quizzed on this. Question. We'll start with a couple of easy ones. Remember that article I read you about that? How many people did the police find shot to death last night at that Ocean View apartment that I told you about? A, 1, B, 2, C, 3, D, 4. Who says A? C. Get this. Get that with a camera. Show us. Get this. Move that camera around. Look how many hands we've got there for C. Okay, D? You're all wrong. Everybody who raised their hand, you are the kinds of people who should never talk to the police under any circumstances for as long as you live. Why is C not the right answer, by the way? If you know, raise your hand. Yes. Excellent. I didn't say anybody was shot. I didn't say gun, bullet, shooting.
No, let's go to the
didn't use any of those words. But I don't blame you if you thought that I did. This is the way the human mind works. We hear things. We fill in details. I said gangland-style slaying. That may or may not imply something, but it doesn't mean that anybody was shot. And that's the problem. You see, even if your client is innocent and only tells the truth and doesn't tell them anything incriminating, and his statement is videotaped, his answers can be used to crucify him. You might say, wait, how can that happen? I insisted. In my insistence, I called the police and I said, look, if you want to talk to my client, you can talk to him, but only if you videotape the whole thing. I don't want there to be any debate between the two of you over what happened. Okay, we'll videotape the whole thing. If the police don't recall their questions with 100% accuracy, he'll be convicted on that statement alone. For example, suppose a man goes to the police. They say, we're investigating a possible murder, a shooting. And the guy says, quote, I don't know who killed Jones, Officer Brute, with all due respect. It wasn't me. I've never touched or fired a gun in my life. How can that help incriminate this man? How could that possibly be used against this man to help convict him? You would think it's inconceivable. But it's as easy as pie. All the officer has to do is read the statement to the jury, and then the prosecutor says, Officer Brooke, was there anything about that statement that confused you or surprised you? Yes, there was, he says in a moment of sinister high drama in the courtroom. And what was that? And then Officer Brooke turns to the jurors, and he says, I never said anything about a shooting. I said we were investigating a murder. He was the one who brought up a gun. Then you turn to your client, and your client says, That's not true. I remember he was the one, or one of the cops, I was with them for 3 hours. One of them in the car said something about, they said they had a witness that I was the shooter. Okay, I'll put you on the stand. And then your client testifies, no, they did tell me shooting. They mentioned it before I said anything about a gun. They brought it up first. And then the police said, that's not true. And now what, it's your word against theirs? For what? You're gambling with your client's life. And police officers can very easily make a mistake like that, just as so many of you did just a few minutes ago, about whether you recalled having heard me say something about somebody actually being shot. Make mistakes innocently, inadvertently, unintentionally, any statement, no matter how exculpatory it may seem on its face, can be used to crucify you all by itself if the police are either willing to lie, not likely, or if they just have an innocent misrecollection of the details as to what they did and did not tell you before you told them what you said. All of these, by the way, all of these problems disappear if you take Justice Jackson's advice and say, thank you very much, officer, but no thanks. How about this one? Here we go. Now, here's the most surprising of all. I've saved the most surprising one for last. Let's suppose you've got the following scenario. Your client's thinking about talking to the police. He acts like he says, I've got nothing to hide. They think that I killed somebody in Virginia Beach last night. Well, this is what your client tells you in confidence. I don't know who robbed that store. It wasn't me. In fact, I got a pretty good alibi. I wasn't even in Virginia Beach that night, last night. I was 4 hours away visiting my mother in the Outer Banks. Unfortunately, no, I did not pay for gas with a credit card. I used cash, and so I've got no witnesses that can prove I was there except my word, and of course, Mama, for what that's worth, which is nothing. So your client says, well, so the police want to talk to me, and I want to seem cooperative, so what I'll do is I'll tell them that I was in the Outer Banks last night. Now, there's nothing on its face incriminating about any of that. Let's assume, by the way, that you believe with all your doubt, you've given your client a polygraph exam. You've known him for years. You've been going to the same Bible study for 30 years. You know beyond a shadow of a doubt that he's telling you the truth. And he's not admitting anything. He's not admitting motive. He's not admitting opportunity. He's not admitting that he was there. How on earth could this come back to haunt us? How on earth could this come back to be used against us? Be honest. Raise your hand if you really think the answer to that question is, I can't see how it could possibly be used against me. You're afraid I'll call on you, right? I won't call on you. Well, you're wrong. You're dead wrong. You're always wrong. Everything you say, every time you talk to the police, you will regret it. You see, the problem is, here it is. This is the last point. I think it's almost possible. Even if your client is innocent and only tells the truth and doesn't tell the police anything incriminating, and the entire interview, questions and answers are videotaped, even his truthful answers can be helped to use crucified even an innocent man if the police, through no fault of theirs, end up in the possession of any evidence, even mistaken and unreliable evidence, that anything your client told them was false, even if in fact it was true. Again, going back to this example from a moment ago. Let's suppose I go ahead and I meet with the police. I think I got nothing to hide. I tell them I was in the Outer Banks last night, officer. How can that be used to convict me? By itself, it cannot. It cannot help at all by itself. But what if I later find out, to my horror, after I put my cards on the table, that they've got a witness, a girl that I went to high school with, an unimpeachable witness, we've never been enemies, she'd have no reason to lie. She swears she thinks she saw me in Virginia Beach last night, a couple of blocks away from that store, about an hour before it was robbed. Now, her testimony by itself isn't going to help the prosecutor. Hell, if she's all they've got, I'll get this case thrown out before trial. But if, like an idiot, I talked to the police and I told them the truth, I told them I was in the Outer Banks, and now, lo and behold, tragically, it turns out they've got the witness, a false, mistaken, confused, but sincere and credible witness, who can testify that I was here in Virginia Beach. Now they're likely to get a conviction. Because what they'll do, I've just turned this cop and this woman into the government star witness. They'll put Officer Brooke on to testify about how my client lied to him about being in the Outer Banks, and then they'll put on this girl, this is the girl that otherwise would have not even helped with their case at all, who will testify, no, that's not true, that was a lie. I saw Mr. Duane's client here in Virginia an hour before the robbery, not so far from the store. By herself, she would not have helped the government in any significant way. But what I have just done, you see, is given them the other part of the puzzle. And now I'm doomed. Just ask them. I close with this example. Here we have a couple of recent celebrity examples of the why-ish that even people who admit nothing always end up denying it. I mean, sorry, they always end up regretting it. On the left, we have Martha Stewart. She was the victim, the subject of an extensive government investigation that was looking into the possibility that she was guilty of violations of certain federal laws, securities laws, fraud kinds of things. They couldn't pin that on her, but they were able to get a conviction because she denied it. Talking to the police and later to someone at the shareholders, she said, no, it's not true. I was not guilty. So they charged her with lying to federal investigators, and they got a conviction, and she was sentenced to 5 months in prison. Marion Jones, on the right side, another person who would still be out today if she had always taken the advice that I'm giving you now. She was asked if she had ever used steroids, a controlled substance. And instead of taking the fifth, she said, no, I never took steroids when I won those Olympic gold medals. Later on, it turned out that she was lying. She worked out a deal. She pled guilty. She admitted that she was lying. And she, over her strenuous, tearful objection, even though she has two young children, was just recently sentenced to prison for 6 months. The guy who sold her the steroids, the pusher, he got only 4 months. But she got 6 months because she lied to the police and said that she did not do it. You see the problem. Michael Vick, who recently pled guilty, as you know, to these charges with respect to the operation of this dog combat sort of operation at his home. At sentencing, like many other criminal defendants, even though he eventually pled guilty at sentencing, one of the reasons his sentence was a little harder than it might have otherwise been, the judge said, was because when he initially met with the police, he lied to them and said, I didn't do anything. I didn't do it. I don't know what you're talking about. Even guilty people, but not only guilty people, will always end up regretting talking to the police. So, my advice to you, Justice Jackson was right. Any sane, competent lawyer in his right mind will always tell every client under all circumstances, I don't care if you're innocent. I don't care if it's the truth. If it's the truth, great. We'll tell the jury all about it. There'll be time enough to put our cards on the table. But before we get there, I haven't seen yet what the police got. They may have mistaken and confused witnesses who will contradict even the truthful stuff that you say. We have no way to know, no way to predict whether the information that you give them, even if truthful and reliable, will end up unwittingly dispelling our demise. So keep your mouth shut. Don't answer any questions. Let's take the Fifth. You'll be glad that you did. God bless America. God bless the Bill of Rights and the geniuses who bequeathed it to us. But now, in fairness, I give equal time. Or what's left of equal time. I was invited to help the prosecutor. You see the problem. Michael Vick, who is of equal time. To a police officer who explained to the extent to which, if any, he agrees or disagrees with anything I've got to say. I have no idea to know what he's going to say, but it'll be interesting. Here, let me give him the microphone. Let's give him a hand. Officer George Group, the Virginia Beach Police Department.
I cannot talk that fast. Not even interviewing. I'm going to take the podium here, Professor. I took notes on some of the things you said. And everything he said was true. Okay? And it was right, and it was correct. And I'm just going to give you a few ideas. I'm going to tell you a few examples. But first, I'm going to give you a little information. As was said earlier, I've interviewed thousands of people. I've interviewed people with foreign police departments when I was in the Navy. I was in law enforcement, and I was a criminal investigator. Thank God we're in the United States, because most interviews in Italy, Spain, and so forth start out physically. Okay, there's no police abuse over there. They can do pretty much what they want, anytime they want, anyhow they want. So just be aware of that and be thankful for you. Biggest question I was asked when I first, I am a 3L, and there's some of my classmates in here. Best day is coming up, May 10th. We get to leave. So those of you that are applying, and I told a couple people this, you think it's hard getting into law school? Try getting out. Okay? Couple things I was asked. How do I quit from getting speeding tickets? Very easy question. Quit speeding. Okay? But something Professor Duane brought up, are any of you guilty of anything? How many of you drove here today? Anybody go above 55 on the interstate? Anybody drive at home and go above 55 on the interstate? Because if you stay...
I did it intentionally.
And there you go. And people are inherently honest, and that's their biggest downfall. Okay, they really are. Or they want to tell their story. And if you drive 55 on the interstate where it's 55, the only thing you're going to do is meet the person behind you, because they're going to rear end you and you're going to get run over. Okay, so that's a fact. But everybody does something that they can get in trouble for. I can follow as a police officer when I was in uniform. I can follow a car however long I needed to, and eventually they're going to do something illegal, and I can pull them over. And justifiably illegal, pull them over. So just be aware of that. Don't think you're so innocent in such a thing. When you get stopped for a traffic ticket, everyone likes to be somewhat honest. And what's the first thing the police officer asks you? You know how fast you're going. If the speed limit's 35, you'll say, 38, 40, because you want to be kind of honest, even though you're doing 50. You just said 38, 40. You just admitted to breaking the law. You just confessed. So they can go to court with that, with a confession, that you were exceeding the speed limit. Okay, so you need to think about those things, and when you do become defense attorneys, which I may, who knows, you need to think about those things for your clients. The other thing you need to think about your client, and this is going to seem very terse, people are stupid. Your clients are stupid. I've had defense attorneys come to me. As a matter of fact, one on a motion to suppress just this Tuesday come up to me and tell me his client was stupid.
Another person
died today. Okay? They're very straightforward. They do foolish things. They talk to the police. You guys need to be aware of that. Now, in my past, and it wasn't exaggerated, I have interviewed thousands of people. I have arrested and dealt with over 1,000 felonies. Well, actually, more than 1,000 felonies. Probably about 20, or not 1,000 felonies, 2,500 misdemeanors. 98% of conviction rate, 80% of them I don't even have to go to court. Why? Because there's confession. Because they confess. So these people have no problem. The hardened criminals have no problem talking to the police. People like to tell their story. And they'll sit in that room and think about it. You're picked up by the police. You're in a little room. There's one chair here. There's a desk. There's another chair. What's the thing you want the most right at that point? Get out of that room. Be out of that room. Police officer's shift is ending in 15 minutes. Does a police officer want to get out of that room? My overtime rate is $58 an hour. Do I want to get out of that room? I have no problem. I'll stay there for 10 hours. I'll take that $600. Okay. So I have no motivation to want to leave. You do. And that's how we get you to try to talk. I have my job. My job is to develop probable cause, develop a good case. A great case is a case with a confession. Commonwealth's attorney, so that they can prosecute the case with little, if any, effort. The Commonwealth attorneys love those cases, a little, if any, effort, because they come with a stack of files that high in court every day. So they love those cases. That's my job. The defense attorney's job is to hope they get to their client before I do and make sure they don't talk, no matter what. Give you an example, and this will go right along with what Professor Duane was putting up his examples. I had an interview that went something like this. Were you involved in the burglaries? No, I had nothing to do with them. You didn't have anything to do with them? No. You were in a car with all this stolen stuff in it? You had nothing to do about it? No. You knew it was there? Yeah. Okay, now we got possession of stolen property, felony. Okay? But you had nothing to do with it? No. So what did you need the money for? I had to pay some of my court costs from another thing I got in trouble for. Oh, so he took the money from stealing the stuff. I have enough to charge him now with burglary. Simple as that. Well, did you see the picture on that camera of the house with the Christmas decorations? This is a real case scenario. Yeah, did you go in that house? No, I didn't go into that one. So there's ways around it. There's ways to get around people who try not to talk to you. And again, as Professor Duane said, if you wanted to go and say you wanted to go into a boxing match, $100 if you win. You've never boxed before. You have to face somebody who's an Olympic boxer. You're going to lose. You're going to face somebody who's been interviewing people for, in my case, 28 years. You're going to lose. Unless you're purely innocent. Now, on the other side of it, I don't want to put anyone that's innocent in jail. But I try not to bring anyone into the interview room that's innocent. There are a couple that I have left away. Okay, the interviews. How do we approach the interviews? There's a number of ways to approach interviews. There's a number of types of people that I deal with. First thing I do, anyone know what they get told first when they're in an interview? Miranda. Miranda warning. Okay, it's not a right. You don't have a right to Miranda. Those rights have always been there. It's called the Constitution. You're just teaching. You're doing a real quick class on the Constitution for these people. Usually they don't listen to it. This is the way I give my Miranda warning. Look, I have to tell you this. Pay attention. Okay, they're usually sitting back or they're very attentive. You have the right to remain silent. Yeah? Understand that? Yes. And anything you say may be used against you in a court. I don't have to say it will be. I say it may be. Okay, and they get that. You have a right to an attorney, and if you can't afford one, one may be appointed to represent you. Got that. You can decide not to talk, quit talking to me at any time and exercise these rights. You understand that? Sure. Now, before I do the primary thing that's needed with those rights, and that's to get a waiver, I say, now, before you say anything, let me tell you what I know. And over all the time I've had to put together what this individual was supposedly involved in, I only say supposedly because Professor Duane's sitting over there, that this individual was involved in, I will tell the story that I've put together, and it'll be pretty close to what happened. And I can see that it's pretty close to what happened because that individual starts slumping down in their chair. They'll put their hand to their face, doing this in their mind, oh, my God, I'm going to jail forever. Okay? And I can see it. I said, now that you know what I know, do you want to talk to me? And why do I do that? Because if I didn't do that, is if I said, you want to talk to me, they'll say no. So I give them the time to think about, and then comes the next phrase. Now, before you start talking to me, let me tell you the difference between a lie and a truth. If you lie to me, and I get before the judge, and I tell the judge that you were dishonest with me, that's just not going to make them happy. But if I get before the judge and tell them you're honest, straightforward, willing to take responsibility for your actions, that is going to help you. That's not a lie, though. That is true. In Virginia Beach courts, it will help them. You know, they may not get 5 years. They may get 3 years. They're still going to prison, or they're still going to have a felony, but it will help them. And then I have to determine what kind of person I have. And there's two types. There's the one, like I mentioned to you earlier, where I have to talk to them about different things, get into their own skin, as the word is, and try and get them to talk to me and discuss things. I had a sexual assault case. I had to talk to the guy how hot the woman was, and I understand where he was coming from. And when I said that, we were buds. And he started talking to me. And he's still sitting in prison. Okay, so you've got to get in there and you've got to go place. The other side is I can't try and act like that individual acts. Okay, I can't try and act like what we call lovingly a hood rat. I can't try and act and talk like him because I'm an older white guy. We don't talk like that, and that would be an insult. And you can't insult people. It doesn't matter who they are. It doesn't matter where they grew up. It doesn't matter where they're from. You can't insult people like that. You have to be yourself. So you have to get into their mindset and the way they're thinking and have a discussion with them. The other type of person is the one that likes to tell a story. This young man, great man. I love him to death. He didn't go to jail because I went to bat for him because I felt sorry for him. He was a newlywed. He was having money problems. Former Marine. I said, tell me what happened. And he told me this beautiful story about what happened. What he had done is he had sold a piece of equipment that his ex-employer had that he had stolen. Told me the beautiful story of what happened about him finding it on the side of the road and all that kind of stuff. I didn't even question about him after he finished his whole story. Very unplausible, but very beautiful story. I sat there and listened to it for 15 minutes. I looked at him, I said, you stole the stuff from your boss, didn't you? Yes, sir, I did. I had nothing. I really had nothing except the fact that he had sold it. So there's those types of people. And then the third type, the one who tries to be the hood, who tries to be the criminal, who cries like a baby when they walk into jail, but when they're on the street, they're as tough as rocks. You go in there with your paperwork, you sit down, and you just start doing paperwork. And usually I have a videotape sitting on top of it, just for measure, so they think I have a videotape. And you just sit there. Don't tell them Miranda. Just sit there and wait for them to start talking. Because they will. They want to talk. People want to communicate. They hate silence. That's why when people speak, you hear, when they're talking, because they need to fill that void with something. People hate silence. So that's the other one. A couple tricks of the trade, and I'll share this with you for when you may go in an interview room, if you're going to be attorneys, it could happen. Videotapes are wonderful things. I use a tape recorder. How many of you think if you saw a tape recorder, that would make you not want to talk? They talk, and this is how I do it. I bring the tape recorder and say, look, I'm going to use this recorder because my writing's terrible. I can't read it if I write it down, so I'm going to use this. Is that all right with you? Don't have to ask me. Is that all right? Yeah, no problem. So I turn it on. And they watch the tape recorder. And if I have a problem with the interview, I'll say, I want to talk to you for a second, just off the record. Everyone here off the record? It's like a unicorn. No such thing. I pick up the tape recorder. I pick up the tape recorder and I go click and turn it off and set it right in front of them. And they look at the tape to make sure it's not turning. Interview rooms have microphones in them and video cameras. And everything that happens in there is recorded. My tape means nothing because I'm recording it anyways. And then I start talking to them quietly. And they start telling me stuff. And they do something like that, except it's crying. More crying. So that's another way. So you see how there's an unlevel playing field here. Even with the most educated individual, there's an unlevel playing field. If you talk to the police, everything's going to be written down. If you get pulled over for a ticket, they give you the ticket, and you pull off. You ever see the cop pull off right after you? Usually not. That's because on the back of their ticket, they're writing down everything you said. And it's going to come into court if you go to court. Everything that's said, I write down. Every phone call I make has to have a listening device on it. Is that illegal? How many parties need to know that a phone conversation in Virginia is being recorded? One. Me. I know it's recorded. I get many, many confessions over the phone. Okay, back to the people. Yes, they're stupid. Okay, people are stupid. I had a young man who told me straight up, I'm going to college. I'm going to law school. I'm too smart. You'll never find out what happened. Okay. He was going to Tidewater Community College. The law school of, I suppose, Tidewater Community College. He was the partner to the one who I told you the interview about just a little while ago, where I would ask him what he needed the money for. He was his partner. And he was very smart. So he thought. He thought he was a very intelligent individual. I ended up arresting him 5 times out of his house. His mother hated me. She liked me the first time. She apologized. She didn't really like me much the second time. It got to the point where she really hated me after that. He's doing 8 years upstate. He's very smart because he decided to tell me how smart he was. And in telling me how smart he was, he let it slip that he doesn't sell stolen stuff to pawn shops. He sells it to flea markets because they do not have to report to the state. I know how to drive to a flea market just as good as anyone else and go look for stuff that I'm looking for. So he was trying to impress me with his ability to be smarter than I was, and he confessed. So people are inherently stupid, especially criminals. Now, and don't get me wrong, there are some very intelligent criminals out there, and most of them work in really big office buildings and wear suits. Yep, she went to jail. Is she hurting? No. But there are some very intelligent street criminals out there as well that get other people to do their bidding and so forth and so on, and people are afraid to turn on them. But there are some very foolish people. Just a couple other things. I do a thing usually with younger people, usually between the age of, I try not to deal too much with juveniles, but between the age of 16 and 25, is once they've talked to me. Now, let's back up a little bit. You don't need a recording in court for a statement. As Professor Duane said, it's his word against my word if he was a defendant. Number one, and this is the way it works, and this is the way the real world works, in case you guys haven't been out there, that's outside the windows out there. The jury looks at a defendant sitting next to a defense attorney. That's strike one, because the jury is already looking at that as being someone who did something that put them in that chair. Number two, they get a uniformed police officer up there. They get someone wearing a suit as a detective up there that is a professional witness. That's strike two. So now they have a professional witness against them. And then if they've confessed and that professional witness is going to sit there and read from his or her notes, the confession, that's strike three. Go get your orange jumpsuit. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. So they have all the strikes against them. And I know you're innocent until proven guilty, but it's a jury of your peers. And the perception is if you're sitting next to a defense attorney, you have to prove you're innocent. And that's just the perception of a lot of the jury. No matter how many jury instructions they get, they still perceive that person is a hoodlum, is a criminal. And no matter how hard some defense attorneys try to put their clients in suits and have them sit up at the table, if the trial is a long trial, they fall back to their old ways and they start acting and speaking in a way that's not very good for their case. So saying that, you don't have to have a recording. My suppression hearing, a statement was trying to be suppressed because when I record a confession or an interview, because we don't do interrogations, the police, we do not do interrogations. That's a bad, mean, Nazi kind of word, okay? We do interviews, okay? You'd be amazed how much difference it makes when you use that one word versus interrogation. I'll take it off the tape and I'll have my secretary put it to paper. Immediately afterwards, I'll take that tape and I'll scan it over my magnet, throw it in my box, so I can use it again. I do not keep the tape. It is not evidence. It's not required to be evidence. It is there. If it's there for the court, it's just extra. You don't have to have that. But it's really good to have. The suppression hearing, he tried to suppress that. After I testified, the defense counsel stood up and says, well, Judge, I really don't have anything to say. And the judge, Judge Canada, said motion denied. And let's move on and go to court. So you don't have to have recordings. You don't have to have videotapes. The police videotapes, that's just extra. If you got that police officer sitting there testifying, you don't have to have that videotape. You got the guy that was right there to tell you what happened. But it's always nice to have those extra things. And what I do for these young people is I'll say, look, the person who you broke into their house are very upset. They're very angry because you sold their stuff to the pawn shop. Pawn shop stuff, sold them. They don't get their stuff back. They're very angry. They want you to go to prison. Okay? They may be very angry. They want you to go to prison. They may want to. To lessen that, that's the start of what's commonly known as a lie, because we are allowed to lie in interviews. To lessen that, you might want to make them happy. And the reason that's a lie is because when it is a felony in the Commonwealth of Virginia, the victim has nothing to do with the prosecution or how long the people go to prison or any of that kind of stuff. We're prosecuting them, not the victim. But to lessen that, what I'd like you to do is write an apology letter to the person whose house you broke into. Just write it out. Well, how do I write it? In your own words, just write, you know, I'm sorry for what I did. Then say that, you know, when I broke into your house the other night, whatever. They write it out. They sign it. I sign it as a witness. I put the date and the time that it was written. I give it to the Commonwealth's attorney. It's entered as evidence as a written confession. In the person's own handwriting. I don't type it up again and have them sign it. In their handwriting, a written confession. Is that person going to get convicted? I have never seen them not get convicted on that. On an apology letter. So, in support of Professor Duane, everything he says is right. That's what I do. Now, to take away the support, I don't try and send innocent people to jail. That's it. That's all I have. Any questions or anything like that? Sir?
Yeah, I was just wondering,